Welcome to Dithering on the Edge of Europe, the podcast about what it feels like to be living in the UK and on the edge of sanity. I'm Rich McCarthy, ex-teacher, ex-energy auditor, and real-life dad and house husband.
I'm Gorla Boom. I'm European. I'm German. I'm a wife and I'm a mother, an academic.
Oh, I'm a wounded badger person as well.
Yes, you went on a badger hunt?
No, not a badger hunt. No. So we just walk along public footpaths to check that there aren't people out doing what they shouldn't be doing hunting badgers in terms of the way that they hunt badgers. They're presently allowed to by this stupid government. They're presently allowed to by insane idiots who I'm not allowed to say who they are, but they govern us, everybody. So we walk around to make sure they're not behaving illegally and doing horrible things to badgers.
But of course, we're not going to talk about badgers. We're continuing our talk about the Green Deal of the European Union, which we started last week. We were covering clean energy and biodiversity, and today we will tackle sustainable industry and eliminating pollution. We talked about wind and solar and the issues about suddenly, you know, it's a rainy day, you know, your electricity falls down because you don't have any electricity coming from windmills that don't move, whereas with bioenergy...
Yeah, that doesn't happen because it's a rainy day. That happens because it's not a windy day. Okay, just to get that clear that you do understand that, don't you?
Yes, okay.
Oh no, it's rainy. What are we going to do with the windmills?
This bioenergy, it's there constantly. Yeah.
Yes, it can be there in the background, ready to, if there's nothing else around, you can switch on the bioenergy.
Yeah.
So that's the idea. The trouble is whether you can get enough of it. And to get enough of it, we have to do massive amounts of insulating of homes, and we've got to make businesses and everything else much more energy efficient so that this bioenergy can make a difference. Because we use a heck of a lot of energy, and you get through a heck of a lot of bioenergy as well if you switched off all the, you know, if you weren't using turbines and you weren't using solar, then there's a lot of energy to need to produce. We need to reduce the amount of energy that we need as a really important part of what we do.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're never going to be able to achieve it.
Yeah. And of course, you know, we talked about cars as well, the biofuels, biodiesel.
Yeah.
You know, that fits into this picture as well. But if we need it to secure land to the amount of making as much biodiesel as we need, then we are getting in conflict with the need of having, you know,
food,
land used for food production. And I think that's also what these policies are. They are policies in relation to balancing the needs between fueling the bioeconomy, but also the food security aspects of that.
Yeah, and that's another reason why we need to get rid of cows and sheep, unfortunately, because the same amount of protein you can get from one field of vegetables, you need 50 fields to get from cows.
With nitrates, you know, which goes smoothly to this third and last pillar, I should actually say, the environmental sustainability. And again, you know, the common agricultural policy feeds into that, of course, tackling climate change action plans feeds into that. But specifically also this notion of low input farming. So with pesticides, you know, less pesticides, nitrates and organic farming. And I have a quote here.
Yeah, because they produce emissions in two different ways. The emissions to produce the fertilizers and the pesticides. And then when you put it on, then they run off and they produce loads of CO2 emissions, nitrous oxide emissions, which are 300 times worse, as we were saying last time.
Yeah. Can you just read this?
In agriculture, the trend towards greater intensification and higher productivity during much of the past 50 years was accompanied by a significant increase in the use of both inorganic nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizers. This led to excessive amounts of nitrates and phosphates in waters and to eutrophication of these waters.
And I don't quite understand what eutrophication means.
I think eutrophication is when there's an over-blooming of algae and so on, because suddenly the algae are going, oh, yeah, this is fantastic, loads of food to eat, and they go mad,
oh,
and
right.
They cover the surface of the water,
okay.
and then everything dies off inside because it's not getting any sunlight.
We had these algae epidemics. I don't know what to call them. You know, algae overrunning. Yeah, exactly.
Red tides.
And there was a nitrate directive, which was first introduced in 1991, you know, when I was looking that up. But obviously, you know, we have to scale that up. We have to make it much more intensive. And it's also what we actually said in the last podcast, that the last 30, 40 years, the cultures within the farming industry went the wrong way. We've rather supported chemical ways of enhancing productivity and not considering the long-term effects on the soil and water.
Mm-hmm. And general environment.
Birds and bees,
literally.
Yeah, exactly. So that was the section on
sustainable agriculture. Only took 40 minutes.
Yeah, I know. So it's a big one. And of course, you know, what makes it very complex is that you have existing policies that is amended to address that. You have new policies and new initiatives that feed into that. And that's what makes it quite complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, all of that, you know, that's the other layer, has to work in sync or has to change behavior at a nation state level without minimizing sovereignty.
Yeah. It's basically people saying nations need to agree that that's a good way to go. And but in the meantime, the European Union can fund things to happen within European nations.
Yeah.
Whether they change their activity or not.
Yeah. And, you know, I still, you know, the more we talk about it.
That's the power of the European Union in a way.
Absolutely. You know, and that's what I just wanted to express, because the more we talk about it, the more I just think the European Union is so unique. It is a thing of beauty in some ways, you know. It's complex, and yes, it's not all perfect. But, you know, that balance, as we always said, between sovereignty and solidarity, if you will.
Yeah, and I was going to compare it to the United States, but that would have been the wrong thing, because people then say, oh, it's the United States of Europe. And it's like, no, it isn't the United States of Europe. And because that implies a lack of sovereignty once again. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so I shouldn't compare it so.
Yeah. And, you know, and I come back to this notion of why does, you know, sometimes the European Union says, oh, why don't we have our own Google? Mm-hmm. And some voices would say Google has appeared because America is so big that it has such a buying power internally that it creates these gigantic companies. Whereas, you know, and of course, some forces within the European Union want to create something similar. Whereas I think it's actually beautiful as it is, because the sort of complexity between these balances, between sovereignty and solidarity, creates an intricate equality of the different, you know, states, where we more likely have a number of Googles that are smaller, each one is smaller, rather than having, you know, one company going big.
Yeah. And actually, I haven't used Google for, I don't know, 2 years.
Brilliant, yeah.
3 years. I now use Ecosia.
I know.
Which plants loads of trees for people.
Oh, does it?
Yeah. So they earn money, presumably they earn money from you using their search engine in some obscure way that I don't know. And so then they use part of that money to plant trees.
I use DuckDuckGo. But as we said before, it's quite a mouthful. Yeah.
Have you DuckDuckGo'd it? Ecosia'd it? But yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but Google is a lot of other things now as well, isn't it? So
yeah.
It's a whole computing industry.
Yeah, but it suddenly ceases to be a search engine, because, you know, when you Google something, the top 10 hits are all about Google products rather than.
Yeah. So yeah. I don't bother with Google. So
we've gone off Google.
And recommend that other people do as well. So, shall we move on?
Sustainable industry.
Sustainable industry. Because the reason that we're recommending you move on is it's not sustainable. And we were looking at the circular economy, and they have split it into five different regions, or they're working on five different things. The first being electronics and ICT. It's quite nice the way they've done it. They've said each time they sort of said, this is the problem, and then this is what we're doing to address it. So the problem being two out of three Europeans would use any gadget for longer if they could. So people are, the people of the world, the people of Europe are annoyed about how gadgets don't last long
enough. Absolutely. You know, your radio gets broken. In prior times, you would have brought it to an electronics shop who would fix it. Or you would open it yourself and do a bit of soldering and
yeah, knob breaks off or the aerial goes wonky or something, so you can't put the aerial back into itself. Yeah. And then suddenly you have to buy a brand new radio just because
exactly.
of that. So what they're going to implement is to make sure that design things are designed to last longer, that they're easier to repair, that they're easier to upgrade. So not just can you repair your computer, but you can put in a faster hard drive or more memory or this, that, or the other. They're easier, therefore, to recycle and obviously to reuse. And they would also encourage products as a service companies. So companies where you hire out something and then it just gets upgraded and upgraded. So
it's similar to, you know, the example of the circular economy when we talked about that, you know, several episodes ago. And there was this company which hires you their light bulbs. So you don't buy light bulbs, but it has lighting services.
Yeah.
So they come in every 3 months and they replace the light bulbs that need replacing.
It's similar to that. I think I don't like that example because I...
You think what, there's a lot of waste actually?
I think there's a lot of waste involved in it because what I understand from lighting, you know, it comes ages and ages ago, there used to be the thing in schools of don't switch the lights on and off all the time because what happens is you destroy the life of the bulb and then they get replaced more quickly. So you're by turning the lights off every time you go out at break time or something, you're therefore creating more waste because more light bulbs have to be made. That is actually untrue because you can switch the lights on and off 16 times a day without affecting the lifetime of the light bulb. But what happens is that when companies come out to replace light bulbs, because it's a bit of a faff, and because it's much more expensive to have the man in or the woman, then instead of just replacing the light bulbs that need to be replaced, they just replace everything.
Everyone. Yeah, but you don't know how the details, you know, that company might say, you know, here's your locker, your light bulb locker. You've got 20 extra light bulbs. You can change them yourself. And then...
I don't know the details. I'm just guessing.
Yeah.
So the way big companies and these sorts of things go. So I prefer the TV company. Idea.
Oh,
so when
right.
when TV, you know, when I was a kid and we had a TV, we didn't have our own TV for
you
ages. We went to radio rentals and we rented a TV. And when something went wrong, the TV repairman came around, banged it a few times. They were always big and strong because you had to be to lift the TVs in those days, and they could repair them. You know, and it's like, oh wow, it works now. So that was great. But then there had to be somebody in the house as well. Which doesn't work so well in our modern time of both couples.
Well,
you know,
it, in the future, it might
maybe.
Work more.
Oh, yeah. Maybe with more people being at home working from home.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the idea. They want to encourage those sort of companies rather than buy it. It's your problem now. Companies, which is what we've got now. The next thing they looked at was textiles. And the problem is, worldwide, a full truck of textiles is sent to landfill or the incinerator every single second. Truck, 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 truck. That's being destroyed or being landfilled every single second. So it's estimated that less than 1% of textiles are recycled.
You know, I still have a top back
it's
from
gone
when
now.
I was
it's
16.
In landfill.
No.
Okay, sorry.
It's still in our cupboard. It has loads of holes in it and I can't let go. And
yeah, well...
It's more than 30
Absolutely.
Years.
That's the way to, that's the, what we've got to do. I've got tops that I use. I've got lots of t-shirts because some of them are used for sport and sport only because, you know, I go and sweat a lot in them and then I don't want to wear that top for the rest of the day. So I put that off. And actually I try to sweat two or three times in it before it gets washed because that reduces the amount of times that you use the washer and it, you know, every time you wash clothes, then they lose a little bit.
Yeah.
And so I have these shirts with holes in them and all the rest of it. And it doesn't matter because all I'm doing is where I use those to cover myself up for privacy reasons to protect the people around me. So
so if you hadn't people around you, you would run around naked?
Maybe. I don't know.
That maybe sounded like, oh, what are you going to give me for it?
Well, I think doing sit-ups with a bare back would mean that I'd rub my back along the floor rather than my t-shirt being rucked up and stuff like that. So I'd still probably wear a t-shirt. Maybe nothing else but a t-shirt. And anyway, I think I better get back to this. I was going to say men have dangly bits that ought to be kept in when they're doing various things as well.
I think women have as well, but there you go. Yeah,
just in different places. So that was textiles. Plastics is the next thing. Plastics, the bad thing is that consumption is expected to double in the next 20 years. So by 20...
Plastic consumption.
The way things are going, certainly. By 2050, there could be, it's saying, it could be that 20% of all oil consumption is used for plastics. And it really, it ought to be 100% because we shouldn't be using oil for anything other than plastics.
Can I just ask, can we just imagine for a second if a rule would be passed, no plastics will be made, manufactured ever again. So how would our world change?
You wouldn't be able to eat. So much of our food is preserved by being wrapped in plastic.
And I was just thinking, just on this table, you know, even not thinking about food, you know, we wouldn't have all these electronic gadgets without plastic.
Yeah, even this, you know, this pad that I've got here has a plastic front to it, which is a good reason for me not to buy that pad again. But
if we use oil for anything, then it's for essential food security, you know, consumer goods, which are essential, like laptops.
Yeah. Well, use it where it makes sense. And not use it for everything.
You know, because of course the common thing is always plastic bags. And I remember a time, you know, even when we lived in the States, you know, at the time there were no plastic bags. You had these paper bags.
Mm-hmm.
And that was absolutely fine.
Yeah. And I've heard somebody say, well, actually, it takes more energy to make the paper bags, et cetera. And I'm sure it does. And I know that I helped a friend who was trying to empty the crap out of his house, and he had bags and bags of plastic bags, and I said, look, shall I just take those to the dump for you then? And I took away a bunch of stuff for him because I had a big car with plenty of space, and I didn't have the various things that were going on for him. So I just took some plastic bags and I said, I'll get rid of these. And I looked at them and I thought, these are all nice plastic bags. They're good quality plastic bags. They're sort of buy them for 10p and then they'll last for a long time. You know, the ones where the supermarkets say, if it gets damaged, we'll replace it for you free of charge. And I wondered about what I could do with them. And I discovered that the best thing I could do was I found a way of folding them all up really small, each of them up really small. I had a load of big, giant rubber bands that I had picked up when I was delivering leaflets for the Green Party in the spring or last autumn or something like that, and washed. And so then I wrap the plastic bags, got them really small, put a rubber band around them, and I keep two plastic bags in my shorts pocket all the time.
Mm.
I've got a couple in my coat pocket. I've got, I gave him some because basically there's so often you go to the supermarket and you go with a couple of bags, you go with two, three bags, and then you buy more than two or three bags, and then you have to get another plastic bag. So these are brilliant because, you know, I get to the end and it's happened so often in the last year that I've just pulled out the plastic bag, whipped off the elastic band, and hey, I've got another big plastic bag and I can use it. I get home, I wrap it up again and put it back in my pocket. And it's saved me buying 100 plastic bags probably.
Yeah, nice.
They also said that 15% of greenhouse gas emissions are likely to come from plastic, and that there will be more plastic in the sea than fish. So greater, I presume that might be by weight. It's greater weight mass of plastic than fish.
And of course, I looked at a video as part of my research in terms of the research project cleaning the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually quite interesting because some of their solutions was to take a gigantic tanker and put all the equipment on the tanker. And it would be a tanker which would automatically roam the oceans, scoop in water and
filter it.
Filter it out. And then they have a sort of biochemical, you know, process, you know, or microbial, you know, kind of process where it gets, you know, destroyed in a environmental, sustainable way.
But
on the boat. So that means the boat would just keep on filtering the water and it would just automatically, you know, it doesn't need to be even manned.
Good. Yeah. Or staffed.
Staffed. Sorry. Apologies.
to 50% of the population out there. Okay, so how to solve it from their point of view is single-use plastics phased out. Full stop.
But, you know, do you remember the party that we had when we still lived, I think it was in Congleton, and we wanted to serve soup, and then there was the whole notion of, you know, we don't have enough dishes. But what we actually did, which was, you know, I thought was a great solution for that, we bought relatively low cost but permanent plastic, you know, what do you call it? You know, they probably would be used for sweet dishes, you know, in bowl form.
Bowls.
Yes.
I thought we just went around the charity shops and we got crockery.
Oh, we did that as well.
Yeah.
It might have been a different party because, you know, I we certainly may, did that in Scotland party, as well. You know, we bought a lot of plates and then we gave them all away again.
Well, not all of them. We've still got some, but yeah.
Yeah.
And it seemed like the best thing was to just go to the charity shop. Yeah, because they're almost giving away plates and crockery and stuff that doesn't fit. And it doesn't fit, but that doesn't matter. The people don't care about that. They just want something to put the soup in or their bread on or whatever.
Yeah, it was a good way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. So get rid of the single use, phase out that and use durable instead. And then restrict added microplastics, so things like in facial rubs, etc., because that's really stupid.
Yeah. Or toothpaste.
Or toothpaste, absolutely. And increase the capture of microplastics at every stage, they said. So,
well, what if...
If you're not using them, you're not using them. Yeah, we should just say, we're not using them. But then there are microplastics caused by just the breakdown of plastic.
Well, I assume, you know, there might be, again, some areas where it's almost essential or where the alternative is worse.
Yeah, there might be somewhere where they're needed, absolutely. So that's plastics. And then food and packaging. In 2017, this is horrific, 173 kilograms of packaging were used per inhabitant of the EU. So that's, you know, that's more than twice my weight of packaging was used sort of on my behalf. I'm sure that we would have had less than that, but that's quite frightening, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the new legislation would be to provide incentives to substitute single-use packaging and tableware and cutlery with reusables and to have targets to reduce packaging. So last one is waste. Each citizen produces, apparently, on average, nearly half a ton of municipal waste per year. So nearly 500 kilograms of waste.
And you probably also still remember, you know, go back to your parents' age, the bin was so much smaller.
Yeah.
And then...
A relatively tiny metal bin. And it was frequently not full.
Yeah.
After a week. And that was with two parents and four children.
Yeah. I mean, I do find, you know, the moment we had recycling, you know, separating recyclables, you know, we never, you know, our bin is seldom full, and then now it only gets taken every 2 weeks.
Yeah, our bin normally has one or maybe two bags in it, which aren't too full.
Yeah, so, and that's different from just 10 years ago, where the bin was more often fuller. I'm just thinking, you know, it has the, you know, the food sector changed a bit.
No, I think the food sector's got worse still.
Right, okay.
To be honest. So waste prevention and recycling, increasing the recycled content of things, minimizing waste exports. That's really important. You know, if we're supposed to be a circular economy, we shouldn't have any waste exports. We shouldn't say minimizing. We should just say, you know, these are targets for 2050, for goodness sake. We should just say we're going to get rid of any kind of export of waste.
Yeah, I agree completely. You know, and we shouldn't faff about anymore. I'm sorry. You know, it's like, yeah, get with it.
Faffing time is done. And no faff. So
we should say this is the green faff deal. No faff deal.
Yeah. And then there'd also, the final thing was that there'd be an EU model for separate labelling and collection of waste.
Right.
So so for separating out different types of waste, and for labeling products and what sort of things are in them, and the collection of recycling. So that was the circular economy. And then looking at sustainable industry, I started off thinking about steel, and a lot of industry is based around steel and cement.
Right.
Looking at decarbonizing steel, presently using 1 ton of steel creates 1.8 tons of CO2, according to Sheffield University, who are doing a study on this. And the reasons for that, you have to heat up iron to melt it. So obviously you're using a lot of energy to do that. That's normally fossil fuels to do that. Then you're adding coke, which is a lot of carbon, and that's used as a reducing agent to remove electrons from the liquid iron. So that means that the iron is then saturated with carbon. It's got loads of carbon in it. So then you put it into another furnace, an oxygen. This time it's a basic oxygen furnace. The basic means you're removing all the excess carbon. So you're sort of going one way and then the other. And what you get out at the end is the steel that you want.
Right.
But you've produced a lot of CO2 emissions to heat up the iron. You've used a lot of CO2 emissions putting in the coke.
Uh-huh.
Well, A, to produce the coke, and B, to add it. And that's producing its own carbon dioxide. And then you're producing carbon dioxide again when you're putting it in with oxygen, because that's how the oxygen removes the excess carbon. So altogether, that comes out as being 1.8 tons every single time. No matter how efficient you try and make that,
right,
you're going to get 1.8 tons of carbon dioxide for every ton of steel created.
Wow.
So we can, instead of doing that, you can use hydrogen in the blast. First of all, you could heat up the iron not using fossil fuels. So there are electric arc reactors. I think they're used generally now for recycled steel, where you don't have to do the coke and you don't have to do the oxygen anyway, because that's already been done, which uh-huh. is great. So the arc reactors can heat up the steel, liquefy it, and then you can remold the steel into something else, and that you've hardly produced any CO2 emissions.
Nice.
As long as you get but you've got to get the electricity from renewable energy, obviously. Otherwise, that doesn't work either.
Yeah, it's, and I know we haven't looked into it, but you kind of think, why didn't we use that from the start? But, I assume those technologies came out and came only slowly to the fore, and maybe some companies are using them, but not others, because how we subsidize or how we fund, it still is cheaper to do it, the more harmful way.
Yeah, yeah, it probably is. It certainly is, in fact. Well, so if you're going back to the basic iron, you can use hydrogen in the blast furnace. And if you use hydrogen in the blast furnace to reduce the iron instead of using coke, then, that works brilliantly, because you're not producing the CO2 emissions for the coke. You're not producing the CO2 emissions when you have to put it into the oxygen afterwards. So you're cutting out a lot of CO2 production that way. But it only works if you're using sustainable hydrogen.
Well, it comes back to the discussion that we had before. You want to actually use wind and solar energy to create hydrogen. Therefore, the Europeans' hydrogen directives, they want to create this large hydrogen-based industry of manufacturing hydrogen in a sustainable manner in order to fuel those parts of the economy which need to have a fuel.
Yeah. Coming back to, so that was looking at steel, and actually then I looked at cement quite quickly. Looking at the British government's idea of how to do this, the first thing they think of is carbon capture and storage, which is really stupid. People will have heard of that a lot. And carbon capture and storage is a great idea. It's like, well, you produce carbon, you capture it, capture the CO2 emissions, and then you stick them in the ground where they can't escape. That sounds brilliant. But where does it get stuck? It gets stuck into oil fields. What happens with those oil fields? That increases the pressure of the oil fields so they can pump out more oil.
Oh.
So it's being used in not the right way at all the moment. And as far as I've been trying to look into it, and I haven't found any research saying how carbon capture and storage is used to just store carbon dioxide. It's always been the big things have always been to get more oil out of the ground.
It's just
which is just ruining the world even more.
I just don't get it. Sometimes I think how did we get to a place where we need such a different type of government that understands the situation that we and the world are in?
Yeah.
Is our human capability not good enough for us to understand we need different types of doing things?
Well, our government doesn't have a brilliant strategy for addressing cement. One thing I did want to say is that a huge thing that we need to do is have a lot more renewable energy. And renewable energy, as in every other form of energy, requires steel. It requires cement. You know, you need steel to make things, cement to anchor them in the ground or the sea or wherever it is you're going to anchor them. And why don't we keep talking about, we've been talking about a war on COVID and all that sort of thing. During the war, we did all sorts of things to melt things down and turn them into bullets because we were running out of metal and so on. That's what we're doing. That's happening now. We should be saying, we're not going to be making this thing. It's stupid. We're not making this thing. It's stupid. This thing. It's stupid. This thing. We should be making instead wind turbines that are going out to sea, and then they're going to generate tons and tons and tons of renewable energy, which isn't costing anybody anything. So the steel that you want to make some stupid device with is not going to be used for that. It's going to be used for making the wind turbines. Yeah. Until we've got enough renewable energy that we can produce the hydrogen that allows us to produce more steel, which then you can make your silly things out of the steel then, because by that time we've got the renewable energy. But we've got to get the renewable energy first.
Right. Okay. Moving on. So the last section, I'm going to go do it really, really quickly, because there's also not as detailed, it's not as big a policy, because again, it feeds into various other existing policies as well. And that's the whole area of eliminating pollution. Both agricultural and urban industry, water management should have a sort of do no harm policy. And that goes actually for almost everything in terms of eliminating pollution. If it does harm, you know, you need to find a different way of doing it. As part of this pillar within the Green Deal, there's the Zero Pollution Action Plan. And that will be adopted by 2021, achieving no pollution from all sources, cleaning the air and the water and the soil by 2050. So the idea is that there will be the CO pollution action plan, which everyone has to conform to starting 2021, which then hopefully slowly deals with, you know, the sort of historic pollution of the last 40, 50 years.
Mm.
And then it, of course, has sort of four areas: clean water, clean air, the industry, and then chemicals. And I've already mentioned in terms of clean water, you know, I've already mentioned, for instance, projects like the CLAIM project, EU-funded CLAIM project, which has loads and loads of countries involved. You know, it had a budget of 6 million euros. And that was about demonstrating how, in real-world conditions, how one could clean the oceans with various methods. And one method had a photocatalytic nano-coated device. There was a small-scale pyrolyzer, a type of decomposer. You know, so there are loads of kinds of solutions in that project that are being tried in order then to put in place. And as I mentioned, you know, one of them is this gigantic tanker, which basically automatically then roams the oceans and has those devices on board and just filters the water and hopefully, you know, in time cleans up our oceans. So that's one area, the water area. Then, of course, there's also the air, clean air. And we already have World Health Organization guidelines in terms of air quality standards, and that can be just simply be adopted. And then measures being put in place to support local authorities to achieve cleaner air. And of course, you know, goes back to mobility, you know, cycle paths, you know. So it feeds into, so it doesn't have as many nitty-gritty policies here, because you can address this through other policies in terms of, you know, sustainable transport and stuff like that. You know, there's an industry section, you know, yes, reducing pollution from large industrial installations, and of course incomes, how do we deal with cement and steel and stuff like that. And it also mentioned improved prevention of industrial accidents.
And those can be done in all sorts, in terms of the pollution from industry. A lot of industries used to take water from rivers, and then they'd pollute the water, and then they'd put it in further down the river. And a big thing, big step that some people realized was, no, you should put the water back in further upstream from the factory.
Yeah.
So that if you're polluting the water, you're taking in the pollution again, rather than putting it in further downstream. Yeah, so things like that.
You don't want to have any pollution.
No, you don't. But that makes them realize more that they're polluting the water.
Yeah. And the last section, as I mentioned, was chemicals. You know, and of course, it is about, you know, protecting us all against sort of the dangers in relation to chemicals, and putting a strategy in to make that happen, to create that sort of toxic free environment. And what are the sustainable alternatives in relation to that? And that was, you know, and that was pollution. So it's quite short, but, you know, of course, it's complex, but you can address pollution in other areas of the policy. Yeah, and as you said in the last podcast, you know, and it's quite insightful, is, you know, because we were talking about if the European Union is the first to adopt sort of the renewable technologies, it has the market advantage. But actually, you know, this is an area where it doesn't matter if you have the market advantage.
You have
want
to
give it away in order for the world to survive, because...
Absolutely. But you need the market advantage in order to be able to give it away. If you let somebody else have the market advantage, who are not going to let you have it, then you're constantly on a hiding to nothing. You know, you're begging for stuff rather than giving it.
Right. So we leave it at that. So,
okay. So a lot of work for Corolla to do now.
Yes, we're. And if you enjoyed the show, tell someone about it. Let us know. You know, use Twitter. Or leave a review. That's also a possibility. And we're on...
Bad one if necessary.
No, bad ones. But we're also on all the main podcast services. And on Twitter, you can find us at @DitheringE, or just look for Dithering on the Edge of Europe. So you can ecosia us. Mm-hmm. You can duck go us. And we would recommend to not Google us, whereas you could find us there as well.
Yes.
Goodbye for now.
And have a fabulous and low-emitting week.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Bye.